This is Allison Steger speaking on January 9th, 2015. The title is Creativity and the Intersection Between Myth and Innovation. This recording was made on DVD. There are a few slides on the DVD in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
Allison is a member of our community and the society. She's a mythologist, writer, and speaker who's passionate about myth. You'll find out tonight. And what it has to teach us about living a more fulfilling life. She holds an MA in Mythological Studies in Depth Psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institute, and she's a member of the National Speakers Association and Toastmasters. In 2004, she founded Mythic Stories, and since then, she's been working with myth in modern culture, teaching in many different ways, for example, teaching Indian myth to yoga teachers in training, teaching online myth classes to gifted children, including her own two, and teaching myth creativity and writing at workshops and retreats. She founded the Seattle Roundtable, the group of Joseph Campbell Foundation folks, and led the group until 2012. She founded the Mythic Stories Education LLC, Limited Liability Corp, which offers after-school enrichment classes on myth and college essay tutoring from a mythological perspective for elementary to high school age folks. She has a blog, and she writes about mythology on mythicstories.com. You can follow up and stay in touch with her. Won't you join me now in welcoming Allison?
Oh, I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for coming out, and I wanted to give a quick shout out to all of you that are new to the Jung Society for the first time tonight. I appreciate you coming out to hear me talk about my favorite subject, which is mythology. Excuse me. I was thinking about this lecture. I've been thinking about it and planning it for some time. And, you know, myth is something that I've been working with for many years, and I love to share the wonderful insights that I find in it as often as possible, as you heard from my introduction. And I was thinking about what was the best metaphor to describe how I feel about the way that I work with myth. And what I'm hoping to share with all of you tonight, and hopefully some of you tomorrow at our workshop, is how to use myth in a more profound way, particularly when it comes to our creative lives and approaching the Jungian concept of individuation. For those of you that may not be super familiar with Jung, we'll get into that a little bit, but to me they are very closely parallel to each other, and I think that they have lessons to offer to each other. So I was thinking about how to capture that in an image, because that's a lot of what myth does for us. And I was thinking about growing up in Alaska, as I did. And when you're a kid in Alaska, one of the things that you get to do sometimes is you get to pan for gold. And they give kids a pan with some dirt in it and a few gold flakes, and you get to, you know, you shake it, you know, and there's, you swirl the water around, and if you're really good and you're very patient, you'll see little sparkles of gold shining up from the pan. And I have to tell you that when you're seven, it's like you won the lottery. I mean, it's just the most cool thing because you're rich. You know? You are rich and you're set for life, and it's just the coolest thing ever. And to me, that image resonates for me, because to me, this is what reading myth is like. Myth, you can read a myth and it'll present something on the surface that may not speak to you right away, but guaranteed, and I can say this with a fair amount of certainty after 15 years of working with myth, there will be things in it that will speak to you. And they may not be the same things that speak to me. And one of the reasons that we're having this conversation right now is because I was very interested in creativity from the beginning of the time that I was working in myth. I've always been a fiction writer, and I wanted to know how to more effectively work creatively. And myth just opened up like a flower, to mix my metaphors, when I started studying it. And it just showed me, as I read myth after myth, that there was so much there that it had to offer. And I believe that it is an infinitely receding horizon. And what I hope to do tonight is not only share with you a few things that I've learned over the years about creativity and myth and what myth can do, what myth has to offer to our creative lives, but inspire you to go and do the same thing for yourself, because it will speak to you in a different way than it speaks to me. And I hope that you can take that away with you tonight at the end of our talk. So that is my hope. All right, has any of you ever actually done this? I'm curious, a couple of you. Yeah, and it's fun. So So having said that, the first thing that I would like to do is start with a myth, because the great thing about working with myth is that you get to tell lots of stories, and I love that. And this one is the goddess Inanna from Mesopotamian mythology. This is a favorite of mine. I've been working with this for a long time. And she has certain attributes, and she has a descent story. And I think that one of the first things that I would like to make clear to all of you is that the descent stories of myth, of which there are many, if you know any myths at all, you probably would recognize that that is true. They have a lot to teach us about the creative process and what one must do in order to really bring back the boon, as Joseph Campbell would put it, or to bring back the thing that's really going to resonate and have an effect on the person who's consuming your work. So, and I will talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But so let's just lay the groundwork here with Inanna a little bit. This is one of the oldest myths that we have that was ever written down. It's one of the original myths that was ever written down from... It was found on clay tablets in what is now Iran, I think, in the 1920s, and was translated back then, and just has these wonderful... She has a lot of wonderful stories, but this one in particular is very rich and full of meaning. So she is called the Queen of Heaven and Earth. She is equivalent in some ways to Ishtar or Isis and is associated with the planet Venus. And she's a goddess, like many goddesses at this time, of both fertility, beauty, and war. And so what we see here is also a relationship with Aphrodite from Greek myth. But you've got a little bit of the Aphrodite and Ares combination that we see if we look at Greek myth going on in one person. So she's the possessor of the maze, which is, and what I've got here is, this is another story of hers, but... She, in one of her stories, gets these maize away from one of the other gods and charms him into letting her have them. But they are, this is a foundational myth of, she's a culture hero in a way, what we call culture heroes, is gods or goddesses that create the structure of a culture for us back in their time. And so these are both the laws and all of the things that made up their civilization, but they are also objects. They are represented as a necklace and a crown and, you know, beads and all these different things. And so they serve two roles in this story in a way. But this is what I wanted to just put in the back of your mind before we start the story, is that they are her jewels, but they are also this other thing at the same time. And one of the things that is very cool about myth and that I love as well is that they're very tricksy sort of beasties in a way, because they're never really straightforward, because they're coming to us out of the collective unconscious. They're coming to us out of the human psyche, and they have a changeability to them that is part of what makes them powerful and still resonant for us, even though this isn't our culture. They have that power because they don't sit still in a way, if that makes sense. So these are some images of Inanna, different ones that I've found. You can see her fertility goddess aspects going on here. And in this middle image in particular kind of shows her as she's going to start off into our story. So what I would like to do, can I just actually need all my space? What I would like to do is tell the myth for you, and I would like to use as part of the telling this poem that I use when I teach Inanna. It's by a mythic fiction writer named Catherine Valenti. It's a long form poem. I'm not going to read all of it, but she does some really beautiful things with the language that I think have a good point here, and I'm going to get into it a little bit more later. And what I would like you to do as you listen is really let your body feel the rhythm of the language, because we're going to talk about why that is actually important and how that can be useful and why that's a part of ritual and why it's a part of a lot of sacred texts. So just, if you can, just maybe close your eyes and just listen to the language. Okay. So here we are at the beginning of the story. Again, she's a goddess of beauty and springtime and all these very rich fertility aspects. And she's decided that she wants to go into the underworld to visit her sister, Ereshkigal. And Ereshkigal is the goddess of the underworld. She is married to Golgana, who is the bull god that is killed by Gilgamesh in the Gilgamesh epic, if you're familiar with that at all. Anyway, he's died because he's killed by Gilgamesh, and so she's in mourning. And she wants to go down into the underworld to visit her sister. And as is always true in myth, this is a dangerous journey, and it requires a lot of us. And what I'm trying to pull out here is that think of this in terms of the creative journey that we go on when we work in the arts or even just bringing anything new into the world. So let's see. So she knows she may not return, and so she speaks to her maidservant and asks her to get help from the other gods if she doesn't come back. So let's see, I'm going to start with this next slide. So she dresses in, as I mentioned, all of these maids that she has in her control are part of her accoutrement, and she needs to wear them. So she starts to put them on. She drew the shagura, the crown of her crown, from a reliquary of drywall and daub. She blew the dust from the twisted gold. She arranged the net of jewels over her hair, black, oh, blacker than the shadow that lies with shadow, and the weight left a mark on her brow. She drew the lapis necklace, wide as her whittled shoulders, from a reliquary of many-colored splinters. She wiped the clinging wood from the stones. She arranged the doubled and tripled strings of beads, blue, oh, blue as the painted horns of lowing bulls, around her ornichon neck, and the weight left a mark on her breastbone. She drew the robe of milkweed and spun sapphire from a mouse's grain-thatched hutch. She combed the pepper and seeds from the stitches. She arranged the breathing cloth around her frame, pale, oh, pale as the dusk of excavations, and the weight left a mark on her spine. She drew her pots of malachite and soot from the cracks of a sunken well. She drained the bracken water from the ointment. She arranged the lines of her eyes, green, oh, green as flooding banks, and the weight left a mark on her lids. She drew the breastplate of beaten bronze from behind her own statue. She polished the dull from the sheen. She arranged the armor of her torso, bright, oh, bright as pickaxes flashing through a grid line. She hissed and she crowed, come into me, come, and the weight left a mark on her stomach. She drew the ring of gold and jacinth from the wheel-packed storehouse. She brushed the sawdust from the circle. She arranged the shining hyphen on her wrist, cold, oh, cold as a pillow left beneath the window, and the weight left a mark on her hand. She drew the measuring rod and line from between tablets bellowing graffiti cuneiform. She smoothed the words from the thread. She took up the sextant stick in her hand, tight, oh, tight as a closed jaw, and the weight left a mark on her palm. Okay. So this is her dressing in her maze. And what I appreciate about what the poet is doing here is the weight at the end of each stanza, right? This is impactful on her. All right, hold on. So she starts her descent into the underworld. Let's see, here's a little bit on that. Flower pounding Inanna, follow the hole in herself to find the hole in the world. Punch through the hill like a hive hexagram. She followed the hole in herself into the hole in the world, and jeweled worm ate earth into down, frog kicking through the slime of secret roots, sand striations above her, clay and charcoal packed below, little white wax woman between, contracting through the curved canal, inching on her belly toward the sounds of her sister sleeping. So she's making her way down here. But, as we know, if you've ever read a myth, one does not just walk into the underworld. That's never a choice. And we'll talk about a couple of other descent myths a little bit later in our time tonight, but there is always a sacrifice that has to be made. And she has to go through these seven gates, as I say here. She stopped, and at each gate, she has to give up another piece of herself, right? So she loses all of her pieces. I won't actually read every single one of the seven, but let me just start you so you get a feel for what I'm doing. Open the door, let me in, sister, my sister. Do not keep me out here with the wreckage of snails and the skeletons of voles. Send your man, Nettie. Unlock this ghastly hangman's plank. And he's the gatekeeper, Nettie. I am Inanna, queen of heaven. My hands fold the stars into seeds. She knows me. I dare say my sister knows me. Open the door. If you are Inanna whose legs lie open, why would you come here through the muck and the mire, past the dung beetle's sentry? There are no flesh-skinned lovers here, or fields sown with carrots. Here is only swamp winds wending. Apple brown to sopping, and Ereshkigal on her pitch-soaked throne. Go home. This is no place for tourists. Hold on. So they had a long conversation. And let me just get to this part where she's giving up the pieces of herself now. So Erich Kegel says she has to give up all of these. So, but Nettie has collar starched and pinned, stopped her. Where there is a gate, there is a toll. The crown of your crown will clatter in my box before you see the back of this door. In that moment, Inanna saw the seven gates clapping before her like an audience, saw herself naked and shivering at their end, shaved to a soap slip. But my head will be bare. I will feel the cold wind on my scalp. Without the crown of my crown, who will know me? Quiet your mouth, Inanna. We have our customs in this country, and you are a stranger here. She did not bite her lip, but she wanted to. She lifted the crown of her crown with both hands and rubbed the red place where it marked her. The crown was so heavy, really. She stood straighter without it. And again, I'm going to actually read those two lines for the rest of the items just because it's part of what I'm going at here. The necklace itched so, she breathed easier without it. The dress bound her so, she walked easier without it. The ointment burned so, and she saw more clearly without it. The metal chafed so, she reached further without it. The bracer was so tight, but blood beat more swiftly without it. But I will be bare, I will be nothing, I will be no one. I will feel the fingers of my sister break off my breath. Without my tools, who will know me? I will not know myself. So she finally reaches Erich Kegel in the underworld. And she has nothing. She's naked. She has nothing on her, but still, Erich Kegel is not finished taking from her, and she takes her life. So, Inanna is killed by her sister. Like a cow prepared for quartering, Inanna was hung up on a hook, and her hair hung down black as ice over deep water. It covered her from the crown of her crown to nacre toes, which pointed down slack as a lynching. That is Valenti's translation, and this is from Goldstein's translation. She struck her, and Anna was turned into a corpse, a piece of rotting meat, and was hung from a hook on the wall. And this is the moment in the myth that I want to really discuss. But let me finish telling you the story. Let's get her out of the world, and then we'll come back to this moment. So she hangs there, like, for 3 days, like maybe other stories, religious stories or myths you may think of. Being in the underworld for 3 days is a very common mythic motif. And, of course, 3 days nights have passed, and Inanna's maidservant realizes that she's not going to return, and she goes to the gods and asks for them to help her. And she tries 3 times, and it's not until the 3rd time that she finds someone who's willing to help. And she finally does get an agreement from Enlil, which is Inanna's father. So, I've got the wrong name here, but it should be Enlil. So Enlil fashioned 2 creatures from the dirt underneath his fingernail, creatures neither male or female. So they're little clay figures. They're not alive. Valenti calls them golems in her poem, which I think is a really nice image for this. And he gives them the food of life and the water of life and sends them into the underworld after Inanna. And because they are not alive, because they have no soul, they can easily slip past the cracks in the gates. They don't have to worry about giving up parts of themselves because there's nothing of themselves to give, right? So they finally get down to Erich Kegel's throne room, and she is having a child. She's in labor. I will spare you reading from this poem because it's kind of gross and graphic the way that she describes it. But what they do is they say, she's like, oh, my back. And they say, oh, your back. Oh, my head. Oh, your head. And she's so moved by this that she grants them a boon. And we have another mythic motif here, which is that usually when the gods offer a boon, they don't really mean it in the way that it ends up being used. And we see this a lot with Zeus in Greek myth, where he grants boons to humans and they make really poor choices. But in this case, she's not talking to humans. She's talking to these little golems, as it were. And they ask for Inanna's corpse, because that is the only purpose for which they are there. Finally, she does give them, after a lot of arguing, she gives them the body, and they take her down off of her hook. and they sprinkle the food of life and the water of life on her, and she arises. And but again, as we get into the end of this myth, one does not walk out of the underworld, as we see with Orpheus, who we're going to talk about a little bit later, and just every other story that there is. There's a price that must be paid if you're going to walk out of the underworld, and the price for Inanna is that she must find someone to take her place. So she makes her ascent. She regains all of her maize that she lost, and reemerges. But she's got these things that are kind of like furies from the Greek tradition following her to make sure that she provides someone else as a placeholder in the underworld, because she can't just walk out. And she comes out, and there's Nishabur, her maidservant. And she's like, you can't have Nishabur. She's actually mourning me. She misses me. No, you can't have her. And they go to another couple of the gods, and they are also in mourning for Inanna. Well, then they finally get to her husband, Dumuzi. And he's dressed in his finery, and he's laying under a tree, and he's got the maidservants giving him grapes, and he's just having a grand old time in his wife's absence. So she says, you can take him. And so they start to chase him, and he runs, and then that leads us into the next myth. So the reason that I start with this particular story, there's a lot of great stuff here, and we could spend the whole lecture talking about this one myth, but we won't. This is the moment in myth that started me on this creativity work. As I said earlier, I started studying myth. I was a creative writer. I wanted to, because you read for your own interests, and the things that will speak to you in the myths are going to speak to what it is that you need to know, right? And I needed to know how to be more effective creatively. I had read Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and there's this great line of Jung's in there where he says that the gods come down off of Mount Olympus and they lodge in the solar, in the body, right? And it's here, right? It's in the gut. It's not in our arm or whatever. It's that. And to me, what he meant, and he may have meant something different, but to me, this is what he meant. To me, what I recognized in that moment was the feeling that I had from looking at great art, or seeing an amazing piece of choreography, or reading an amazing novel, or seeing a painting, or watching a film that really moved me. I felt it in my body, and I wanted to know how to make that happen to the people that were consuming my work. That was what I thought myth had something to offer me in this area, and this is going to be probably the work of my life, to try to figure out how to do this in the best way. But what I think this myth has to offer is around the moment of the meat hook. And what I see here, and this is one of those moments in life where, you know, you're in that place half awake and half asleep, and you're sort of open to the unconscious mind. And I had studied this myth quite a bit at Pacifica in different classes, and I was thinking about the meat hook in that moment. Like, why is she on a meat hook? I mean, there's psychological reasons for everything that happens in myth, right? This is why Jung loved myth so much, because he saw a lot of wisdom in it. And what I remembered, as I mentioned earlier, I grew up in Alaska, and my dad hunted, and every fall he would go hunting for caribou or moose or whatever, and he would hang the carcasses on meat hooks in our garage. And not that many people probably have that image as part of their day-to-day lives, I hope. But I remembered it, and the reason for a meat hook, if you've ever seen a documentary or whatever that had pictures of slaughterhouses, those cow carcasses are hanging there. Why are they hanging there? They're hanging there because the fluids from the body need to drain out. And what that said to me was, even after she died, Inanna wasn't done, right? She had given up everything that she thought was herself, and she thought that she was done when she was naked and shivering and walking into Erish Kegel's throne room. But she wasn't done. She was killed. But even after her death, she still wasn't done. She had more to give to that deepest place in the underworld. And that was the deepest part of herself, right? She had to give that up, let that drain out into that deepest part before she could come back with the things that she had learned in the boon. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with Campbell's work, but Joseph Campbell, but he talks about this hero's journey of separation, initiation, and return, which is what he saw, the pattern that he saw in myth, in which heroes often go down in a descent, and then they come back up with a boon, like, you know, some kind of treasure, right? It doesn't have to be an object. It can be just a lesson learned or whatever. And what this said to me was, this thing that I'm trying to do by making art, I can't just half-ass it. It has to be I have to give from the deepest part of who I am, or else I'm never going to be able to connect with the people that are reading my work. And I think that this is true, and I think that we know that you can recognize that this is true if you create art. There is a sacrifice that has to happen, and we're going to talk about this in further detail as we go forward into the lecture here a little bit, but it's not something that you can just do and that isn't going to require anything of you. You're going to have to really give from a deeper place than you would ever really feel comfortable doing. So that was what this myth said to me. So does anyone have any questions about Inanna before we go on to more descent myths or talk about more of the ideas that I'd like to bring? Yeah?
I was just going to make the comment. Didn't Adrian, Ariel, I think is her name, have the book about the seven gates of life that you go through?
That's possible. I mean, this is a myth that has a lot of richness to be worked by multiple people. So, and I can never do it all myself for sure. But yeah, I mean, I think we recognize that there are gates that we have to go through, right? We have moments that we have to give up a piece of ourselves. But what I love so much about Valenti's take on this myth is that she has this moment of like relief almost. That's sort of very subtly, that's why I made a point of saying it's leaving a mark on her, but then it was a relief to give it up a little bit. So we, you know, there's that sadness of loss, but there's also that moment of, maybe this is something that I need to give up right now, right? This is something that I need to let go of in order to continue on with my journey. Does that make sense? That's one of the things that I like about, I encourage all of you to read this whole thing. It's really, really fantastic. You can buy it for $3 off her website. Other than that, it's not in print, but fantastic. If you want to look at this, you're welcome to. So let's see. Okay, I talked about how I found my way into the myth, and before I go any farther too, there is one thing that I make sure that I always say when I'm teaching, because I think it is so important when we're talking about creative work. Every single person on this planet has something to offer that is unique to them. And I have met so many people that believe because they are not a Van Gogh or a Mozart or a Shakespeare that they don't have anything to offer, that they can never match the great, great works of the world. So they don't want to do it because it's scary. You know, doing this work is going to demand something of you, just like pursuing individuation, right? If we're talking about Jung's work as well. But without taking that risk that is required of doing this work, that thing that you know that no one else knows is lost forever. And to me, that is the greatest tragedy. And I've met so many people that just, they're afraid, or they're self-conscious, or they compare themselves to others, and they think that what they have to say or do or bring into the world isn't important. And to me, that is a huge tragedy. So I would invite all of you, whether you consider yourself a creative person or not, to think about creative work in this way, to remember that you do have something that you need to offer, and that we will all be the lesser if you don't. So do it. And I will get into this a little bit more as we go on. So, and I just found this quote actually this afternoon by Eli Wiesel: if we do not transmit our experience, we betray it. So that thing that you learned, because no one else has your story, right? No one else, even if you have a twin brother or sister, they do not have the same story you do. They do not have the same experiences you do. They do not have the same insights, that something that occurred to you that hasn't occurred to anybody else. And if you don't bring that back out to the rest of us, it's lost. And I just cannot let that happen. So this is what I often tell people when I teach my workshops, is just please try. Don't be afraid. Okay. Oh, of course.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a work or an experience. It can just be the presence of that unique personality.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, but I guess my perspective is if there's something you've learned, the rest of us want to hear it. I mean, and you don't know how you're going to affect other people. And I have had experiences where I'm talking to people and they just all of a sudden burst out crying because something that I've said has moved them in a way that it was something that they absolutely needed to hear. And if we are afraid, that stops, right? And you don't offer that back to, even if it's just, I'm not even talking about creating a huge painting or writing a novel or writing a film or whatever. It can just be in your life and conversations. And this is a nice segue because I'm going to talk about artistic creativity versus everyday creativity on the very next slide. So it's a very nice segue. So let's see. So what I wanted to do too in just a brief moment is talk about some of the most current research that's happening in the world of creativity right now. This is the way that the two types of creativity are being distinguished in creativity research right now. So we have this so-called artistic creativity, and Jung has a few things to say about this that I'm going to get to in a second, and everyday creativity. Those are two different ways of approaching our creative work, and this is maybe the difference between creating a great work and just living your life in a creative way. So, and I think myth has things to teach us about both of these aspects of the way we might approach our creative work. So, and again, this current research is, this is current papers published within the last year. So we've got a quote here from Jung I wanted to share. And this is, he would not have used the language differentiating because that research wasn't being done when he was alive, but art is a kind of innate drive that seizes a human being and makes him its instrument. The artist is not a person endowed with free will who seeks his own ends, but one who allows art to realize its purposes through him. So, you know, I'm sure there are people in this room that are more expert on Jung than I am, because I am a mythologist and not a Jungian analyst. But so if you have something to add to anything that I'm saying about Jung, please do so. But I love his approach both to creativity in the arts and to myth. He had, a real appreciation for both of those things. So this is kind of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the work of, like, big creativity, so to speak. This is, you might call it big or small creativity. This is writing an opera or writing working as in the creative arts in some way as a profession. But we also have this other thing that has been neglected in research until very recently, which is called everyday creativity. And this is just where you live your life in a creative way, whether you are doing collage art on your own, or you're writing in your journal, or you are just kind of trying new things in a way that is taking a small risk as far as your creative work is concerned. If just doing that alone, this is from a paper that was published last year. Those scoring high in everyday creativity also tend to report a feeling of greater sense of well-being and personal growth compared to their peers who engage less in everyday creative behaviors. So this is just another argument for do something. You know, just make creativity a part of your life. It will benefit you. Even if you are not aspiring to be some hugely famous type artist or even working professionally in the arts. So just a couple more thoughts here about Jung on creativity. So as I mentioned earlier, I believe that the creative process shares many parallels with the process of individuation. And I believe Jung would, if he was here, he's here in spirit, would agree with that statement. And from the Encyclopedia of Creativity, we've got this: the process of individuation is key to understanding Jung's theory of creativity. So turning inward and downward, as we saw on a myth, is the path toward connecting the conscious, unconscious, and collective unconscious, which is the point of individuation, as I understand it at least, that you're going down deep into yourself to bring up those things that are fairly far down into your own psyche. And this is, collective unconscious, is, of course, where the myths live, right? And in my opinion, this is where many of our stories come from. This is the source. So when you make a descent like Inanna's, you're trying to get as far down as possible to get to the good stuff. So, and again, this is why I think myth is so powerful, talking about this creative work, is this story teaches us what to do, and it's 6,000 years old. People cared about this 6,000 years ago. And, you know, I think it's more than just about the story as it is appearing on the surface. When I started to read myth in this manner and looked at multiple myths with the eye toward creativity, it becomes very clear very quickly that caring about how to energize ourselves in this way was an issue for early people as well. So, all right. So I mentioned this a minute ago, but myth has, among many other lessons, a pattern of descent into the underworld followed by return to the upper world. So we see this over and over. Orpheus, Persephone, Mwindo from the Congo, which we're going to be talking about tomorrow, is an epic from Africa that is really powerful and includes a descent myth. This is just a very, I mean, Joseph Campbell saw it. This is his point, right? There are, if you look at the hero's journey, it's a big loop. It's not a straight line. The hero goes down and comes back up. This is why this pattern is was so obvious to Campbell, I think, is because this was what myths were and often. So. These descents and returns of myth model the path to individuation for us. So I'm actually just curious, is there anyone here who disagrees with me about this? Because there are, I know, analysts in the room, and yeah?
It's not, I'm not understanding
okay.
I guess I didn't understand when you told Dinella's story. Mm-hmm. I didn't catch what problem she was trying to solve. Like, what was her doom? Like, why did she go there, and why did she...
Well, okay, so there's... It never actually says in the myth what she's after. So it could be that... I mean, some people think that she's trying to connect with the other half of herself, which is represented by Erskigal. Some people think because Golgana has died, she wants to take over the underworld, and it's a power play. So there's, you know, there are multiple ways you can actually read this particular myth, but to me, what it's showing is that she has to give up all those parts of herself, and then she gets them back. And what she's, in my opinion at least, gaining from it is the experience of having done this. And she's bringing back that wisdom from that collective unconscious, place of unconscious or collective unconscious. That's my opinion. This is what I'm sharing. So if you have a different one, then that's great. Anybody can have a different one. That's the beauty of myth. It's just very elastic, and you can read it to see what it is that you need to learn from it. So, hi. Yeah, Shirley.
I always think of Inanna as that when she's that little crispy being that's hanging on the hook there, mm-hmm. and everything's gone, all of her adornments and her power, her authority, everything's gone, is that she's down, she's burnt down to the essence.
Absolutely.
And that's what you need to get to, is that
right.
essence of who your authentic self is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, I agree. And she's teaching us how to do it, right? I mean, if I could tell anyone one thing about myth, if I could teach any of this to anyone, if I could have 1 second to say something, it is that myths show us that things go back up. That you can descend, you can be in a descent state for a long time, but people sometimes think when they're in descent states that are going to last forever, that their depression is going to last forever, or the pain from their divorce is going to last forever. And myths show us that that's not really the case most of the time. Obviously, people die of illnesses, and that those descents, you know, that's a different thing beyond my ken, obviously. But I think that it's these stories that are over and over and over again in the world's myths show us that you don't have to despair, because it will turn around, and you will bring something back with you. And I think in this story, it's mostly just wisdom. Sometimes it's a literal thing in some stories. But I think it's almost more powerful that there isn't one thing that she brings back, like an object, because it's what she's learned from the experience, I think. So, but again, I would invite you to read it in your own way and bring that one thing out of it that I could never, because I don't have your life. So, okay? Anybody else have a, say, no, individuation is not like myth. Anybody want to say that? Okay. No. Okay. Well, I'll be doing this in San Diego next weekend, so we'll see what they say. Maybe they will fight back about this idea here. But to me, it seems, I mean, my work with Jung's, my study of Jung's work is, you know, I've learned some about individuation, and I think that looking at it through a prism of myth versus from the analytical side gives me a different take on it. So that's why I like to ask if anybody who's come at it from a different angle has a different opinion. So, all right. So I'm going to move on to Orpheus. I want to talk a little bit more about descent myths, and then it'll be a good breaking point there, and then we can talk about all kinds of other fun stuff. So this is another descent story, and I don't have a cool poem that some other awesome poet has written to share with you. I'm going to have to work on that. But he's the shaman poet. He had his own cult of, he was considered to be a shaman because he came from away from Greece, a part that was actually getting close up to where shamanism originated in Siberia. So people thought of people that came from that part of the world as shamans. And he did have his own cult, that Orphism, that grew up out of his myth. And the part of his story that is a descent is after he marries his wife Eurydice. She's a dryad, and he falls in love with her, and he's this amazing musician, right? That's what he's the most known for, right? He is a lyre, and he can charm the birds from the trees. He's got this incredible gift for music. But he eventually falls in love and marries Eurydice. But she is desired by another mythological creature of some kind. I can't remember exactly what he was. He might have been a centaur. But this is the kind of stuff that my kids that I teach really love to hear about the monsters. But anyway, so she's running away from this attempted rapist, and she steps on a snake and dies on their wedding day. And Orpheus is so heartbroken at the loss of his beloved that he uses his gift for music to charm his way into the underworld. And he, again, as we just learned from Inanna, one does not just walk into the underworld and walk out of the underworld. He goes down into the underworld, and his music so moves Hades and Persephone that they allow him to, they grant him a boon again. It's said in something that I read earlier today that this was the first moment that Persephone's heart truly melted after being abducted by Hades. Hearing Orpheus's music opened her heart to Hades. That's an incredible gift to give to a couple, right? And he convinces them to let Eurydice go. And this is not something that was done very often, but of course there's a catch. There's always a catch, and you know that they will trip on the catch because that's the way myth works. So he will ascend back up out of the underworld, and Eurydice will follow him. But if he turns around to look at her, she will be pulled back down. You guys probably remember this part of his story, right? So right there, you know what's going to happen. Guaranteed, especially with the Greeks. I love this story, too, talking about descent, because he's a creative artist, right? His life is creativity, but he has to do this. He has to walk a very narrow path. And in some ways, I like to think of this path downward into the place where we can give of ourselves to bring the creative boon back is like walking on a razor's edge. And I think that we've seen this in some ways with our greatest creative artists in human history. I mean, we've got a lot of suicides and drug addicts and alcohol addicts and philanderers and just a lot of really extreme behavior on the part of a lot of our artists. And I think that that is a result of this walking on this razor's edge. It's a very dangerous thing that I'm asking you guys to do. Forgive me. But it's an important thing and needs to be done for our culture and for our people. So of course, he starts his ascent back up. Eurydice is following him. I'm actually going to skip ahead, too, because I have an image. And then right at the last moment, as he's exiting the underworld, he turns and he looks back at her, and she is pulled back down and lost to him forever. Well, until his own death later, but he spent a few years with his head floating down the river and singing. So, as it happened, he actually became kind of a jerk to women, apparently, after this, and was finally torn apart by maenads, and his head went floating down the river, still singing. So this one was blessed by Apollo, for sure. He's the god of music and the lyre, for sure. So I just shared that image with you. He teaches us how to live in the dangerous spaces of the borderlands. And this is something that I'll get more into after the break, but what it means to be living in the borderlands or being close to a border. So we have this sense of certainty about the world as a child. I think at least if you had a relatively normal childhood, you had a sense of safety and certainty in your childhood. But what happens as we start to grow up and we, whether we're using that word or not, work toward individuation, you have to let go of some of that certainty. And Orpheus is a really good guide for this sort of thing. Because we, as I say, use that word Aegeus. I love that. It's a shield that Athena carries, Aegeus, and it also just means protection. It's come to mean a word that's used to mean protection. And we had that as children. And I had that myself growing up. I grew up in an evangelical Christian home, and it was a very difficult thing for me to do to leave that behind, which I eventually did because I didn't want to live in that space of certainty anymore. And I wanted to live in that place of uncertainty and be able to ask questions. But when you have the religion that you grew up in, this can create that sense of certainty, and it's a very scary place to leave. if you really feel like you know the world and you know what is going to happen to you after you die and you just have all the answers, then it's safer, you know. But if you have to take less risks, then you're going to be gaining less from the experience of living outside from under that. So this quote is from one of my Pacifica professors, Robert Reminition. He says, "The poet is a danger not because he lies, but because he does not know that he is possessed by forces that are outside his mind." And what he's talking about here is the danger of that journey that we have to make. So does that make sense to everybody? I know that I kind of whizzed through Orpheus really quickly. I apologize for that. But does anyone else have any thoughts about this myth or what I'm talking about with the sense so far? Have a question or comment, anybody? All right, and before we talk about time, it's almost exactly 45 minutes, so let's take a quick break, have some tea, have a cookie, and we'll get into some more interesting concepts. I hope you'll find them interesting, at least, when we get back. Thank you. Sorry, what? 15 minutes? 15 minutes? 15 minutes, everyone? All right. Okay, so now what I would like to do is I'd like to turn a little bit away from specific myths, but more myths tomorrow. But for what I'd like to do now is take us a little bit on a journey through time and space, which I'm pretty sure that is a phrase from Doctor Who, and I've probably been watching too much of it. but I want to talk about time and the places in which we can be getting into that space of where we can create. And there's so much support in myth for taking a little bit of a leap. But first I want to talk about time. And so we've got some, I wish that I could figure out how to only reveal these bullet points one at a time, but I don't quite know how to work this computer. So we have two words here that I want to talk about. And this comes to us from the Greek language. We have the word chronos, and I'm sure you recognize that word as part of some of our English words, like chronometer. We get, a word for time. And what this Greek word for time means is like day-to-day life, right? Clock time, running errands time, data entry time, just anything that is just sort of regular and not inspired or exciting, just the things you have to do through to get through a day. But it's also a name for one of the Titans. This is Zeus's father. He was defeated by Zeus, and he is Father Time, really. But the Greeks I could do a whole lecture on just how brilliant the Greeks are, and they've got two words for time. And the second word is kairos. And let me just go ahead here. So this is another word for time, and it means that sacred time that comes when you've sort of lost track of time, right? When you are playing with your child, when you are painting or writing, or you're just in the flow of the moment, and it's sacred. It's also the time when you're even in church and you are experiencing God or experiencing the sacred. That moment is kairos. And it was really interesting to me because I was in Greece in the fall leading a retreat, and we were at a house in a very remote part of Crete, the island of Crete. And we were talking about the labyrinth and Ariadne, which is some things we're going to talk about tomorrow. But we created this labyrinth out of candles, and we were staying in this house, this beautiful house by the sea, and this woman who owned the house we were doing yoga and doing myth and creativity on a retreat, and she led yoga retreats there. And she was obviously Greek, and she was listening to me talk about Kairos and Chronos, and she is Greek. She speaks Greek. Greek is her native language, and she knew the word Kairos, but she never thought about it in this way. She knew what it meant, but it just didn't, because it was so familiar, I think, and it just kind of blew her mind the way that I talked about it, because she said, "I never thought about it that way," but she's a yoga teacher, and she has those moments of Kairos in her yoga practice, but she never thought about it maybe outside of a religious context. She wasn't exactly clear, but you know, maybe that's just the kind of thing that happens in church or whatever, but it can happen anywhere. It can happen in nature. And these are the moments that we're striving for as artists or just as people. These are the magic moments of life, right? This is that time when it's, I mean, this is where we are approaching the space where the gods are, right? And this is where myth is. So we have a modern word for it. Flow. Is anyone familiar with this word, flow? Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. I finally learned how to say his name. yes, Csikszentmihalyi has written about flow very famously for a number of years. He also has a book on creativity in which he interviews writers, creative artists of different kinds about being in a state of flow. And he's famous for using the word flow to describe this very thing. But the Greeks did it first. A long time ago, the Greeks did it first. So to me, this is an important concept to try to hold on to, at least when I'm doing my own creative work, because this is what I'm striving for. When I'm writing, I want to get there, because that's when the really good stuff happens, right? And I think that what you have to do is you have to do that work of the descent that we talked about earlier, but this is almost the boon for that, right? You get your reward by having this, being in this state of Kairos time. But you have to put the work in first, right? You have to take those risks, as we saw Orpheus doing and Inanna doing. But this is the reward you get. And this is about understanding the importance of fertility in myth. Now we see there are a lot of fertility myths in the world, around the world. We have a lot of myths that are similar from different cultures around where their signature crop came from, taro root or corn or wheat or rice. And we have in Greek myth, we have the story of Demeter and Persephone, which I will not be able to go into too deeply, but we have that happening everywhere. And as you start to read more and more myths, it's just, you understand, and you can kind of understand it if you think about it. Think about back in antiquity and how difficult it must have been to keep one's animals alive, one's crops, one's children, oneself. And, you know, this fertility, this is a really key, we don't really appreciate it these days, understanding how important it is to have fertility, right? Unless you have fertility issues as trying to become a parent, you don't really think about it much. We don't think about, because we have so much medical help and help for the crops and things that we don't really think about worrying about starving to death because all the crops have died. So there's a lot of fertility goddesses out there. And to me, that there is a really close connection between what the ancient stories have to tell us about fertility and what it has to say about creativity, because it is the generative power of bringing new things into the world. And to me, that's, I wouldn't say exactly equivalent, but it's, there's, you know, they have things to say about each other, right? And what we're trying to do here is, this is the thing that I think is so wonderful about us as human beings, is that we get to do that. We are the only ones that do that, as far as I know, at least. I don't know of any animals that are creating art or anything other than their own children. This is the magic of human beings. So we want to understand how, by understanding and looking at fertility myths, we can understand creativity as well. So I was going to talk a little bit about Demeter and Persephone's story, but I think that we're going to move beyond that, because we've done two descents already, and talk about a different part of the mythic tradition. So last year I was teaching an online class for gifted children, as Kelly mentioned in my introduction. And one of the classes I was teaching was comparative mythology. So what we were doing was going around the world and looking at the stories from all over the world, and looking at each culture over a year. And one of the guiding principles of the class was very Jungian. I don't know if all their parents approved of that, but because I'm Jungian, that's how I talk. And it was looking at whether or not a myth was specific only to that culture, or if it was connecting to something in the collective unconscious. And the way that we knew that, it was by looking at whether that story appeared in a similar form elsewhere in a different culture. So we had a lot of conversations around, is this just for this culture, or is this something that is universal to us as human beings? And so you could have a story that's almost identical between Aboriginal Australia and Ireland, and then you know that there's something else going on here. So we have, as I'm sure all of you know, Aboriginal Australian myth has this idea called the dream time or the dreaming. And what that means is that they you know, again, I'm not an expert on Aboriginal issues, but I will say that it's this beautiful idea that the world and the landscape itself is absolutely sacred the way that it is, and that the dream time is this place that where the gods are from that is right next to us, and that every stone is placed where it is because that's where the stone is in the dreaming, and so therefore it has to stay there because it is paralleling so closely this place where the gods are that is right next to us. And it's just right there. It's right on the other side. And what I love about this idea is that it's echoed all over the world. We have this idea that the gods are right here, just on the other side of a curtain from us. So we see that also in Ireland. And they love to talk about this idea of the thin places, right? That there are places in the landscape, that there are places in times of the year in which that curtain between our world and the world of the gods becomes very thin. And that is a place where there is sacred energy, right? And that on Samhain or on different holidays of the year that the gods can come from that through that curtain and walk or things like that. So to me, this is a very similar idea to the dream time. This is this panel of protection between our world and the world of the gods is just almost permeable, and it's right there. I have this poem here that I'd like to share. Thin places, the Celts call this space, both seen and unseen, where the door between the world and the next is cracked open for a moment, and the light is not all on the other side. God-shaped space, holy. I have a couple of images here that I'd like to share with you. Some thin places in Ireland. You guys see those? I know it's light in here. Turn that down for just a second, yeah. I really want that to pop a little. This is Polnabroin Dolmen in the Burren of Ireland. My family and I went there last year, and it does have a real resonance to it. I mean, you almost feel like if you could walk through the passage of the tomb that you would be in a different place when you came out the other side. And it's absolutely inexplicable. It really shouldn't be to me because I'm a mythologist, but this feeling that you have there, all these stones on the ground of the Burren, and there's these little wildflowers and these little crevasses between the stones, and it just had this power to it. And I don't know, and I've never been to Australia. Has anyone been to Australia and been in the outback and experienced that sense of the dream time at all and the sacredness of the landscape? So hopefully I get there someday. But, and there was lots more cool pictures of thin places in Ireland, but this is an example of what I'm talking about. This is a place in culture where we and myth that we have this. So again, this is coming up in stories all over the world, and I believe that this is where, like, the representation of, in the representation of myth, where we are getting close to the collective unconscious. Like, that place is thin between us and it. So in the shamanic tradition, now we have shamans in all parts of the world, not just in the Arctic, but they're medicine men in lots of cultures and things. And their job as a shaman is to travel into that space, right? For healing, for resolving disputes, for just any number of things. They can change themselves into animals, things like that. And again, this is a journey into what I believe is the collective unconscious. And shamans are trained to make that journey on our behalf. And I believe, and what I was trying to get at, and I may not have successfully completely done with Orpheus, is that he is the shaman and the poet, and poets have this job too. Not just poets, artists. So this is what we're doing here for our culture, as artists, or as people that are working creatively. we are going into that space on the behalf of those of us who can't, or the people around us who can't do it. And we're bringing things back with us. And it goes into our art. And it affects people. And it changes lives. So we have the shaman going into that space. Okay, so just a little bit more here about that. And, you know, it's interesting, having studied shamanism, how the training happens if you become a shaman. Sometimes people are born into shamanic families. Sometimes people become shamans because they've had a dream that they were shamans. And sometimes people become shamans because they've survived a really serious illness. And that, to me, is really interesting because, as I'm going to talk about in about 30 seconds here, sometimes that is the way in which you can access that space. And this is where what we see going on with a lot of ritual. Myth and ritual are very close to each other, and ritual is often, the point of ritual is to access this place. And I have some examples of that that I will share with you here in a second. But here's a picture of a shaman. I love that image. You know, and I just have, let me say a couple things about this. He's got a child here that he's healing. That's the point of this. This is from Alaska, you know, which is my home of origin. And he's got the mask on because he's in sacred space. That's what the point of that is, right? You know, you can take it off and he's his regular self. But if he's communicating with the gods, he can't just wear his regular face. He's wearing a mask. And this is where you see a lot of the masks from, just around here even, in the Haida traditions and some of the beautiful masks that are made by artists that go all the way up into the Arctic. That's what those are for, right? All right. So as we whip around the world here, now we're going to go to Turkey. So Australia, Ireland, Alaska, Turkey. Get lots of frequent flyer miles tonight. So we've got this tradition among the Sufis of whirling dervishes. You guys ever seen? Let me actually go forward. I'm going to show you a little. This is just a little GIF here. Okay, so these gentlemen here are whirling, and it just shows them whirling, and that's the point is not to see that they're whirling, but the point is to, and you can't even really tell from this, but they're almost in a trance state here. I mean, and that's the point. The point is they're whirling. I mean, this is obviously a show that's probably for tourists or whatever, but they really do look like they're seeing God on their faces. If you really look at their faces, you can see that they are using the movement of their bodies to access this space. And we see this in ritual and all over the world, using the people use fasting sometimes, or I know the Sioux have this sun dance where you pierce the skin or the muscles of the chest. And, you know, and I could list you many, many more examples of ways in which people are trying to get into this space. People have been doing this for all of human history. This is what this is about. This is what dancing in masks is about. And just moving the body, right? And they're trying to get here. And this is what artists are especially good at, in my opinion. They have this space that they have carved out for themselves at the margins. And this is what Sufis are trying to do, and this is what artists have to do in order to be an artist, right? They are trying to cross over that border into this sacred space of that Kairos time that I was talking about before. So Henry Corbin has this great line, at the margins, the edge, rigidities get broken down, and one is closer to the source. And in turning, the dervish becomes an empty space where the human and the divine can meet. And I am very much intentionally conflating creativity and the sense of God here, because I think that for artists, at least, accessing this space is the place where in which they can be inspired to create. So, this is a little bit what I was trying to get at with Orpheus and his art, is that creative energy comes from the other side of this barrier. And artists, oh, yeah.
I heard it said, I don't know if this can be relates, but I heard it said somewhere at one point that shamans go to a basically do these things so the rest of us don't have to.
Well, artists do the same thing.
I was thinking about that as you're talking. Mm-hmm. Would you tell the normal person to go to the extremes of, say, you know, the eccentric artist or the shaman or something like that, or find a minimalist?
I would, but I would encourage them to be in analysis while they were doing what I mean by that is that it is dangerous. What I'm asking you to do here is dangerous. And, you know, and there is an argument to be made for living in everyday creativity. You can be happy, you can have a fulfilled life, you know, you can get a lot of the benefits of living creatively without the dangers of really living creatively. But I do think that the artist, if they're really going there, so to speak, you have to take this kind of a risk. So, and I think that that's why we see so many artists kind of going off the rails, you know, killing themselves and drinking themselves to death and whatever. Yeah, well, you know, and I really do think that. I think if you want to get the good stuff, you're going to have to take a risk, and it's going to be dangerous, and you're going to put yourself at risk. And it's going to have an impact on your family, it's going to have an impact on your children, it's going to have an impact on your relationships, every kind in your life. You have to decide for yourself, so that's a price you're willing to pay. But if you do make that decision, you will be able to create in a more effective way, and I think the myths can guide us to this. Which is basically the premise of my whole argument here. So I just don't think that you can do the work that you might want to bring into the world without understanding. You need to understand that it's dangerous. But I think that myths can help guide us to doing this maybe a little bit more safely. Maybe it's like, you know, but at least we know, we can see how other people have done it, right? And it can guide us a little bit, and we can say, okay, well, at least if I know what I'm going to have to give up, then I can make a decision, an informed decision. But absolutely, it's dangerous, and I would not want anyone... Well, okay, I shouldn't say I wouldn't want unstable people to try it, because maybe those are the people that are best equipped to do it. But, this really is... At the bottom line here is that this is a scary, dangerous thing. But I would also argue that going down that path at least a little ways... is what is going to keep you, I mean, being on this border at least a little bit is what individuation and the pursuit of individuation is all about. You have to make that descent as part of the individuation process, so you're never going to fully mature. I mean, that's what individuation is about almost, is really becoming a fully mature human being. So, does anybody else have a comment or question about this? Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you're going to talk about your career. I would find value, I would say, more likely to be found in working with my own heritage rather than exploiting another's heritage.
You
help the common themes, but right. I think we should also respect that in the context of the culture is where the richness comes. So for me, if I explore the Irish, I would find a level of something there that might be different for me than someone who isn't, or if I was to go into someone else's culture.
You're talking about cultural appropriation,
yeah.
Right?
And that is
certainly something that I struggle with every day as a mythologist, because for one thing, I'm an American. My family has been in the United States since the 1600s, and I don't necessarily know what my culture of origin is. And our country, as Americans, does not have the kind of ancient myth that we can find from other cultures. And I will say, though, that having traveled some now, I did find a resonance in Ireland that I have not found in other places, because my family is mostly Irish, I think, maybe, maybe not. But, I mean, there is something to be said for that. But what I try to approach this work, and I would encourage all of you as well, with as much respect as possible. When I write about myth, I try to talk to members of the community about which I am writing and, you know, get their input and make sure I'm not completely going off the rails. And I've worked quite a bit with the Haida the Haida mythos, and I'm going to talk about that tomorrow, by the way, Raven. But I had had the opportunity to talk to some members of the Haida community about that, and it certainly is something that I think everyone working with myth needs to keep in their mind, out of respect at the very least, because there's been a lot of tromping on other people's traditions, especially as a white person. You know, I need to be very careful about that, and I want to be respectful about that, and I want to learn what I can from these stories, but at the same time be as respectful of the cultures that they're coming from as possible. Okay, so this is, rather than a descent, and it sounds like I'm mixing up all of this together, but I'm really trying not to do that, because this is a sideways step. This is not a dig down into the hole in the earth as Inanna did, and there's more beautiful imagery in that poem about her just pushing herself through soil and becoming all dirty and becoming something other than what she was. But it's, again, this is, I love this Harry Potter idea because it's, it's still being used, right? It's still resonating with people, this idea that you have to enter another state of being by taking a step out of the world that you're in. And that's exactly what Harry Potter does when he steps onto platform 9 3/4. Okay. So, just the last couple of points here. I hope this was holding together well for you guys, but myth holds the wisdom of ancient peoples encoded, and if we look beyond the surface of each story, we can see the creative lessons, which were useful in ancient times, continue to be useful today, and I really do believe that there's a reason why these stories survive, and obviously there are plenty that didn't, but if you will try to pan for gold with your, I would encourage all of you to not just listen to what I'm talking about here, but go home and read a myth and just sit with it for a while and see what your intuition is telling you about that story, because it will offer you different things than it offers me, and I think that it's just got this sort of ever-receding horizon of power in these stories, and I would really love to hear, if you come up with anything, if you go back and read Inanna and you find something in it that I haven't noticed, I would love to hear about it. And again, this is, I think, useful when we talk about individuation, because it's that process of connecting those three states of consciousness. Some of this I've already kind of mentioned, but we working creatively helps us work toward our own individuation, and the myths can teach us how to navigate those thin places into which we can access our creative energy. And as we move across that border, it's going to test us, as we talked about. But again, more tomorrow. We're going to talk about tricksters, we're going to talk about Ariadne and labyrinths and minotaurs and Mawindo and lots of fun things. So let's see. One more slide. Again, dangerous. Have I hammered that point in well enough yet? We bring the treasures of the dreaming back to our community, and we must find those brave souls who are willing to open their hearts and minds to hear what the depths have to teach them. Does anyone else have a question or a comment or a reflection for me? Yes?
Would you say that's maybe why superhero stories, comic book movies, and stuff like that has become so popular in the last 10 years or so? Because it is, in a way, our own American mythology?
I would agree to a point, because I guess that in some ways superheroes are like gods, because they're superhuman, really. They have abilities that the rest of us don't have, right? And those are all things that are true of the gods. So yes, I mean, you can make that argument. I also have this whole theory about how celebrities are our modern day gods, because back in mythic times, we had temples for the gods where they were worshipped, and now we have movie theaters and sports stadiums and websites that are called altars and shrines to different celebrities. And I think that celebrities hold some of that archetypal energy for the culture. And I think that we see certain celebrities breaking down under that pressure. Not too many of them handle it well, because they're human beings, but they're holding an archetypal energy. Like, my best and favorite example of this is Marilyn Monroe. She was holding the archetype of Aphrodite. and she couldn't handle the pressure. So, and I think that you see that archetype recurring in different women, as, you know, different women kind of come forward as actresses, and they have to hold that for the culture. I mean, because they have no choice, the culture puts it upon them, and they can handle it in a, is, you know, they handle it in the best way. I wish I could almost go and tell celebrities, this is what's happening to you, and this is what you should do. But I feel like that part of our culture is holding some of that right now, because, but they're also still human beings, right? So that's a whole nother thing. But does anybody else have a comment or observation that you occurs to you? Yeah. Oh, hold on. I made this guy right here.
It's kind of a question.
Oh, sure.
You said fertility goddesses. Uh-huh. And how we have so many of them. I just wonder, what do you think of, like, Monsanto? Like, in terms of, because, I mean, I thought about it. Just...
Yeah. Well, that would certainly be more Erich Kegel style fertility goddess, certainly. But, you know, there, as I briefly mentioned, there is an argument that Inanna and Erich Kegel are two halves of the same person, right? So, you know, I haven't talked much about the shadow today, but this is a concept of Jungian thinking, right? I would say that Monsanto is the shadow aspect of our current fertility, absolutely. Monsanto holds that shadow. For that part of our culture, absolutely. Yeah.
I wonder if you have any thoughts on maybe for fertility gone wrong or creativity gone wrong. Like, if you have any insights or to point me to, like, any stories that talk about in a mythic way, like how, like, being creative endeavor, like, maybe can go wrong and what that means for the person who, like, for instance, Hephaestus.
We're going to talk about Hephaestus tomorrow, actually. That's one of the... And the whole point of the Hephaestus myth for tomorrow is to understand brokenness. I think that's what Hephaestus has to offer us creatively. He's one of the most creative of the Greek gods, and he's broken, and that's part of his power. So come to the workshop. Amy, you had your hand up a minute ago. Amy? Transformation of it?
Yeah, for example, you were mentioning the light and the dark, the shadow, the fertility, all of this. Do you see that as relevant to bringing about individual breakthroughs as well?
Let me make sure I understand your question. Are you asking if once one gains access to the collective unconscious, if that's transformational? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's it's essential, honestly, because that's where the stories live. So, whether you're painting them or writing them or choreographing them, that's where they are. I'm sorry.
Do you have any comment on the recent tragic events in France?
Oh yes, I do. But they're going to be part of our workshop tomorrow. Yeah, because that's our section on the trickster. Oh, absolutely, and I've just, that's the trickster. I mean, satire is the essential energy of the trickster, and I have a lot to say about it, a lot, but it wouldn't fit in my lecture, so it's going to be a section of the workshop tomorrow, absolutely, and we're going to process some of that for sure, because I, at least personally, have emotions around that incident that I need to process, so you guys are going to help me out. But, see, I sped up again. I'm sorry. Does anybody else have a question or comment for me? Well, thank you very much for listening to me. I appreciate it so much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.